So let's go ahead and begin, and thank you for all five of you who are here in the audience today. The panel is entitled 9/11, Mormons and the Winds of War, Recent Dialogue Authors Publishing 21st Century Peace. And I'd like to dedicate this panel today to the memory of my brother Carl. If he had survived the injuries from his car accident 7 years ago, he would have celebrated his birthday today, April 17th. In the shadow of the 2001 terrorist attacks on the Pentagon and Twin Towers, Latter-day Saints share with their neighbors and friends across the globe a profound interest in the fortunes of 21st century war and peace. But what precisely is the responsibility of the individual Latter-day Saint in an era that remains uncharted, changed, and clouded by the threat of potential apocalypse? If turning to the scriptures yields conclusions as different as those reached by the authors in the current War and Peace issue of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, if most latter-day pronouncements on war predate the advent of the nuclear age, what kind of compass should we carry to determine that response? With such questions in mind, I issued a call last May for papers on war and peace to appear in a special thematic issue of Dialogue 20 years after the journal published its first issue on the topic. The response was large, fervent, and decidedly anti-war. In fact, I had to commission papers espousing pro-war positions. But the resulting issue, on sale downstairs outside, offers a rich sampling of our views on contemporary war and peace and demonstrates unequivocally that we care deeply about the challenges that lie before us all in a post-9/11 world. Today's panel will highlight the responses of several of those passionate authors, including one participant who supports the war in Iraq. Let me introduce ourselves now in the order in which we'll speak and then offer some of my own thoughts on war. My name is Karen Maloney, and I'm professor of English at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. I earned my PhD in modern British and Anglo-Irish literature at UCLA, and while a grad student there, engaged in civil disobedience at the Nevada test site to protest the continued testing of nuclear weapons. More recently, I did protest our war against Iraq. I served as editor of Dialogue's special issue on war and peace and wrote the essay Wicks, Modems, and the Winds of War. Our second panelist, Barney Haddon, earned his PhD with me at UCLA in medieval English literature and responded to my plea to put his pro-Iraq war sentiments into an eloquent personal essay. Barney teaches writing at the University of Utah and authored the eloquent personal essay of Wars, Maps, and Ideals. He also wins the prize for most perilous mute to be with us here today. And I'm planning on hearing more about that later. Deborah, or Debbie Sheridan, immigrated to Utah from England 4 years ago and now teaches with me at Weber State. She received an MA in history from the University of Aberdeen, Scotland, and an MED from Weber. It was Debbie's job in the Dialogue issue to represent the viewpoint of many European saints who opposed the war, and she too graciously responded to my plea to write an essay for us that would do just that. It's called From Flanders Fields. Mary Dixon earned a BA in journalism at the University of Utah. She's a citizen activist, writer, and host of the nightly Contact series on Utah PBS stations. She's also the author of Living and Dying with Fallout, and today she is recovering from unexpected major surgery on Thursday. And she asked me to read her paper in which she gives us a preview of the summer issue of Dialogue in which her much more fully developed essay appears. Our final panelist, Patrick Mason, is a PhD candidate in American history at the University of Notre Dame, holds an MA in International Peace Studies from Notre Dame, and wrote The Possibilities of Mormon Peace Building. Like Barney, Debbie, and Mary, Patrick is a first-time, and hopefully not last-time, Dialogue author. He also wins the prize for longest commute to be with us on this panel today, all the way from Indiana and on a grad student. My own experience with war, like that of many American women my age, has been meager. Even so, war provided an ever-present backdrop to my childhood and adolescence. I grew up here, in sunny Southern California, in Whittier, where my mother still lives, in a neighborhood teeming with children of the veterans of World War II. Baby boomers, for whom our father's overseas service was a point of pride. My own father's stateside service as an MP, courtesy of a car accident in childhood when flying glass punctured his left eye, disappointed my brother, Carl, and me. but it couldn't prevent us from joining enthusiastically in neighborhood games of war. We learned to distinguish in our speech between A-bombs and H-bombs, the roughneck boys anxious to play the Germans, the gentler boys, and all the girls, American. Now, this is odd, of course, because I'm half German, you know. Anyway, on one occasion, acting in a dual role as the American general and head nurse, bolstered by my brother as head spy, I carefully vaccinated all my troops on our back patio before engaging in memorable battle with the boys across the street. You can talk with me later if you want to find out what happened that particular day. By the time I entered high school, World War II had been replaced by a war our fathers wouldn't fight. As I shifted my role-playing from suburban streets to a high school stage, already graduated cousins, friends, and boyfriends were leaving for Vietnam. A high school junior, when troop escalations peaked, I wrote to them, and one by one they came home. Wounded, silent, changed. George required a cane to walk. Rich would be lucky later to marry my best friend Yola and father children. Dane was addicted to drugs. The day after Dane's release from rehabilitation, he shot himself with a rifle in the bathtub while his parents, my cousins, attended church. Denny Miller, whom I'd met as a handsome Marine, stopped writing one day. Was his the name I traced years later on a visit to the wall? I joined in one large anti-war rally here in Claremont on Pomona College's Marston Quad, which is just over that way. We're transferring from Pomona to BYU, but my energies were focused on my courses, social life, and the new church I joined after high school graduation. When Saigon fell, I was a 20-something adventurer teaching high school in Australia, and events seemed remote and unreal. In 1980, however, I read two books by British writer Vera Brittain. Her life as a sheltered young Victorian woman, born in 1896, had been shattered by the advent of the First World War. One by one, during the course of the war, her fiancé, Roland, two close male friends, Victor and Jeffrey, and her beloved brother, Edward, were killed. Shortly before the war ended. She mourned each death deeply in turn, but their cumulative effect devastated her. She had left Oxford University, one of the first women to attend there, to serve with all the idealism of her generation as a nurse in London, Malta, and at the front in France. Nursing such patients as the victims of mustard gas provided memory-searing close-ups of the horrors of war. When she came home, grief-stricken and depleted, she began her lifelong work to prevent anything so calamitous from happening ever again, lecturing, for example, for the Infant League of Nations. It would be 10 years before she recovered emotionally enough to write Testament of Youth, a book at once autobiography, history, and elegy that endeared her to the public. Later, as she documents in its sequel, Testament of Experience, Brittain sacrificed that popularity by denouncing in a widely circulated booklet Churchill's saturation bombing of German cities during World War II. In Brittain's carefully detailed accounts of the century's first 50 years, I learned the history of modern armament with its escalation to weapons targeting large numbers of civilians rather than limited numbers of soldiers. I also felt her sadness when World War II began. As she commented on, quote, the utter failure of all the sincere efforts made for peace through 20 years, unquote. And I admired her as she proceeded, nevertheless, to convert slowly and thoughtfully to pacifism. Then, against the intensity of her efforts to dissuade her country from bombing museums, cathedrals, monasteries, women, and children, I struggled with her to comprehend the genocide perpetrated against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The logical next step, more terrible by far, in saturation bombing. The event staggered her with its enormity. Reflecting, however, that she, her political scientist, fellow veteran husband, and their two children had themselves survived the war, she also found herself, quote, increasingly aware of a deep thankfulness which submerged even the guilty sense that too many others were sad and suffering for joy to be appropriate. Such a poignant reaction to the catastrophic destruction differed dramatically, nevertheless, from that of the victim. I think of Michael Ondaatje's character, Kirpal Singh, or Kip, the Sikh sapper in the novel The English Patient, who during the final days of World War II, painstakingly, defuses unexploded bombs to protect the Europeans they endanger. Kip's skin is brown, like the Sri Lankan-turned Canadian Andache, like that of the Japanese victims at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And when news reaches Kip of the bombs dropped on those two cities, the previously reserved soldier who had brushed away other racist and personal slights blasts forth as though he himself had been detonated. My brother told me, never turn your back on Europe, the deal makers, the contract makers, the map drawers. Never trust Europeans, he said. Never shake hands with them. But we were easily impressed by speeches and medals and your ceremonies. What have I been doing these last few years? Cutting away, defusing limbs of evil. What? For this to happen? When Kip aims his rifle at the Hungarian Count Almashi, the dying burn victim to whom the novel's title alludes, the Canadian Caravaggio reminds him, Almashi isn't English. Kip retorts, American, French, I don't care. When you start bombing the brown races of the world, you're an Englishman. You had King Leopold of Belgium, and now you have Harry Truman of the USA. You all learned it from the English. Caravaggio, Andache tells him, knows the young soldier is right. They would never have dropped such a bomb on a white nation. Perhaps Kip's outrage opens a small window onto the sense of perceived injustice that must have simmered beneath the surface even for decades after his return to India, an eager resumption of civilian life. Perhaps it speaks, too, of the vast building energy of Eastern resentment toward the West. Neither Vera Brittain nor any actual person resembling Andache's Kip foreseen the events of 9/11, but I don't think the epic scale of its tragedy would have surprised them. The decisions made by 21st century terrorists to fly planes into the Pentagon and Twin Towers can be traced like a series of genetic mutations back to landmark 20th century adoptions of military strategy. The dropping of the atom bomb on cities inhabited by civilian members of a brown race, Churchill's attempts to obliterate entire German cities, and what Chris Hedges describes as the technological and depersonalized levels of organized killing begun in World War I that have defined warfare ever since. The events of 9/11 will undoubtedly divide us as utterly from the 20th century as the atom bomb demarcated its two halves. Lawrence F. Kaplan and William Crystal tell us that day brought us to a new era, fluid, perilous, and very much subject to the contingencies of history that define those moments when one epic has died and another is struggling to be born, an era for which a new roadmap is required. But even another round of map-making may not take us where we need to go in the years that lie ahead. For that journey, we may well need, too, a new compass, perhaps even one that would allow us to follow the lead of the Community of Christ, formerly the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and reposition ourselves as a genuine peace church. Well, I can dream. But in the meantime, I refer you to an intriguing essay in our issue by Andrew Bolton, who serves as the coordinator of the Peace and Justice Ministry for the Community of Christ. And yet, one of the books our issue reviews and from which I drew, who are writing own essay in the Philadelphia airport, where I was destined to spend an inordinate number of hours last November, is Chris Hedges' War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I sampled it heavily as I traveled, you can call it traveling, by as I traveled home that day, and I felt, after reading it, that I had physically visited a war zone. Hedges was for many years a war correspondent, and he writes vividly, telling us more about man's capacity for cruelty than one would ever like to know. He documents as well the relative speed with which soldiers required to kill at close range become desensitized to an activity that initially repelled them. He makes a convincing case, too, for the addictive quality of the drug we know as war. I came away chastened from Hedges' book, grateful for the peace in which I've always lived, since, too, a new appreciation for U.S. military power. If darkness of the world can be kept from our shores, how much of our ability to deter it is derived from our reputation as a military colossus? I still protest this war. I still deplore Bush's determination to develop and test nuclear bunker buster bomb in a desert that has already felt too many radioactive winds. But I do know that the peace in which my playmates and I imagined our clever games of war in the streets of a Southern California suburb has been purchased for me with the sacrifice of soldiers like George, Rich, Dane, Denny, and my friend Patty, a former student and now an Air Force lieutenant currently serving in Kuwait. Another of my Weaver colleagues, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Robert Hogue, could not be with us here today. But I urge you to read his essay, War is Eternal, The Case for Military Preparedness, for another vital perspective on the war and peace puzzle. In the true spirit of dialogue, then, we present here today, and in the War and Peace issue, which I urge you to obtain, downstairs, Arvin will be selling them, you can go straight to him. All right. And the next one coming up will have the fully developed essay that I'll be reading of Mary Dixon. I urge you to obtain a copy and read it. But today we'll be presenting a range of replies to the haunting questions now troubling our sleep and requiring revolution in a new era that awaits. And before I close, I would just like to specially welcome Garrett Congo, who just walked in. He was a freshman with me at Pomona College and is now a wonderful poet. He happens to be here at the same time I'm here, so thank you.
Arguments that I made in the essay and dialogue, which at this point seem 9 months old, and about the situation 9 months ago, I thought I'd do a little reevaluation. The premise of last fall's argument was that my support for the war in Iraq developed largely as a reaction to the failed rhetoric of the left in trying to convince me and others that that war was a continuation of a history of policy of the past. But to support something is to take an affirming action. Ironically, I wound up supporting a war prosecuted by a conservative administration, largely for reasons that I thought and still think are quintessentially liberal. Those of you who read the essay published in the most recent issue of Dialogue will recall that I discounted the administration's primary rationale for the war, at least those that seem to dominate the discourse preceding the conflict. Those are that the Iraqi government was somehow linked to al-Qaeda and to the terrorist attack on 9/11, and that Iraq posed an imminent threat to the United States. I didn't feel either case was made in a satisfying way, but found other arguments that were offered at the same time more persuasive and genuinely deserving of my support. So I'll list six arguments that were made during that period and then comment on each one looking back at a year. The first, of course, the first compelling reason previous to the war was that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction that he had stockpiled and never destroyed, would be willing to use against other people. The second was that Saddam Hussein represented a threat to his neighbors, having in the course of 20 years attacked three neighboring states in what appeared to be a support for his own vanity more than anything else. The third argument made was that Saddam Hussein was a threat to his own people, having used his military internally to kill citizens in a sort of sometimes genocidal way and always to intimidate. The fourth argument that I thought was important, though not compelling, was that Saddam Hussein could be removed from power by military with comparatively small loss of civilian and military life. A fifth argument was that Saddam could be replaced by an incipient democracy, rather than a continuation of despotic dictatorship. And the final of the six is that the U.S. could act without territorial or economic ambition being their primary motivation. So, after a year, I look back. WMDs, of course, were not found in Iraq. This means that Saddam had less capacity to threaten his people and his neighbors than I believe, because the decision to go to war is the most consequential action that a president can take. The fact that Mr. Bush chose to go to war based on false intelligence is troubling. To some of my friends, it's unforgivable. Conservatives comfort themselves by pointing out that the intelligence services of nearly all nations in the world, the members of Congress from both sides of the aisle, and previous administration, and David Kay, the weapons inspector, who was commissioned by the current administration to investigate weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, has theorized that even Saddam Hussein believed that he had stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, that he may have surprised him, that is, as much as it did anyone else. Nevertheless, in looking back at my own support for the war, this is really the largest error in my thinking and the most troubling one. If it is true, as some now argue, that intelligence reporting was biased, president gave signals to his staff that he wanted certain conclusions to be found to be true in intelligence reporting, then I think that's the gravest of transgressions involved here and the most immoral action of the administration. But I think it's yet to be persuasively demonstrated. As to the second conclusion, it might be argued that after the fiasco in Kuwait, Hussein was no longer an external threat, that his actions were focused inward in Iraq, and that the UN program of sanctions and inspections might have contained the threat. I do agree that Hussein was less belligerent after the first Gulf War. On the other hand, I'm not sure that this indicates either that the sanctions were in any way helpful, and I don't think that it supports or that it suggests that weapons inspections under the Hussein regime were anything but a complex shell game. In a game of three-card Monte, if the queen disappears from the table, the mark is less likely to win, not more likely to win. As long as you've got three cards that aren't what you're looking for, you can never win. The sanctions program, on the other hand, was just a complete disaster from beginning to end, so far as I can see. Corrupt, the bribery of UN officials in the Food for Oil program is a great disappointment. It's estimated by human rights organizations that the sanctions cost millions of Iraqi children their lives without measurably discomfiting Hussein or his family. What we've learned in Iraq since the invasion is that we underestimated the terror of the Hussein regime, that it was more horrible than we thought it was. And so, in some way, I think all are agreed that Iraq, at least, is a better place without Mr. Hussein being in charge. Now, a note on the loss of life. It's one of the horrible arguments that I feel like I am compelled to make, that we lose only a few hundred troops and only a few thousand civilian lives. That's a good thing. That's a moral victory in some way. By historical standards, the war was fought in a way that had never been seen before. With precision and concern for civilian populations that has not characterized war, at least since the 19th century. It's unprecedented to fight that way, to care about buildings and about civilian lives and markets and things like that. It's not unprecedented that the army that the coalition forces faced with COVID. It was predicted in analysis before the war, and historically it seems just to be a pattern when Western armies face soldiers from that part of the world. Alexander defeated Darius's army, as I recall. Alexander lost 100 soldiers in the exchange, put to rout an army of 250,000 with his army of about 50,000, and I think the casualty ratio was 500-1. Once the army of Darius turned tail, the forces of Alexander just chased them and killed them at will. Disciplinaries and Marines of the kind that the coalition brings to the field are incredibly admirable to my mind. In that they fight particularly well, and they seem concerned with doing a difficult job that they don't, as armies have historically, pillage and rape and wantonly vandalize the places that they visit. And for someone who studied the wars of the Middle Ages, the difference between their ideals of war and the reality of war, it's a difficult thing for me to imagine that an army can march in and march out without retribution against others for friends that they've lost, without seeking to personally enrich themselves by... Army soldiers in the early days of the war discovered hundreds of millions of dollars sitting in buildings and then left it and reported it and turned it over to authorities. It's extraordinary. On the fifth question, the question of whether democracy will come to Iraq, that's a thorny problem. Democracy is difficult in a culture with virtually no native tradition. It seems in some ways antithetical to the hierarchical nature of the Middle East, and particularly of the Islamic religion in important ways. The only force for secular democracy, the only argument, I guess, for secular democracy that is made in Iraq is that without a secular democracy, Iraq will split into three different nations. I think the neighboring states are not particularly excited about a functioning democracy in Iraq, and particularly Iran would prefer a Shiite theocracy. That said, there is an underreported fact about Shiite southern Iraq that I find interesting. There have been so far in that area 15 municipal elections held since the area fell to coalition forces. In every one of those 15 elections, all members of the religious party were defeated in secret ballot elections. Each election was attended with high rates of voter turnout. Both men and women voted. The people elected have been largely professional: doctors, teachers, businessmen, and men and women are represented on the city councils in these areas. Remember, too, that I think the United States and allies in World War II were successful in persuading Japan, which also had very very little tradition of democracy, from imitating its historical political models and becoming a democracy. And democracy in Japan is not particularly Western. In some ways, I think Western analysts are confused by the way it works, but it's nevertheless democratic. Finally, I still believe that the U.S. acts not because it covets Iraqi oil reserves or wants to have a vassal Iraqi state, but that it acted and continues to act because it believes that a functioning democracy in Iraq is a measurable improvement for the Iraqi people, for the region, and for the world, which is a position that I'm inclined to agree with. One of the points that I made in the essay that I wrote is that it drives me crazy that because we've done things so badly in the past, people think that we can't act in the present. That is, no matter what we do, we're destined to repeat the evils that we've done in the past. And I'm hopeful that not only can we improve the situation in that distant part of the world, but we can in some way improve ourselves and do something good for the world that's not entirely motivated by our being able to buy gas at a cheaper price or bananas or whatever the commodity is. Thank you.
Funny about peace, love, and understanding, asked the modern day minstrel Elvis Costello. Sorry. Okay. Another asked, war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. As a Latter-day Saint, a child of the 60s who lived through that era in a country still recovering from the ravages of World War II, I learned to fear war. As we entered into a war, fought by terrorists on our own streets, everybody was touched, and I learned to dread war. As we were led into other wars in patriotic fevers created by double-speaking politicians and saw the living and dead remains of our armed forces return, I learned to loathe it. In anticipation of the attack on Iraq, I actively demonstrated and spoke at public meetings against the possibility. Why? Because I'm an un-American alien? A subversive, a peacenik, a hippie? If standing for truth, brotherly love, and peace makes many of those things, I am guilty as charged and unrepentant. I abhor war and find no justification for declaring it, especially just because we don't approve of the politics of the latest country to be declared our enemy, while our politicians hide their actions from the electorate. Thankfully, in neither the US or Europe am I alone. My family lives in the UK, where in the early 60s they were converted to be Latter-day Saints. I lived until 1999 when I moved to Utah to further my studies. As a British Latter-day Saint living in Utah, I'm a peculiar animal. Not being raised a cultural Mormon meant that my religious views were tempered less by what my neighbours think and more by what I learned in Sunday school, sacrament meetings, and seminary. In a land where only 2% of the population are churchgoers, being a Mormon meant being abnormal, bizarre, and outlander. We were taught in church to question, to understand why we chose to be so different from our fellow men. I understood the gospel to be one of love. My parents in the multicultural world in which I dwelt taught me to accept all men as my brothers, black, white, Sikh, Jain, Muslim, Buddhist, Catholic, we free, or atheist. I was also taught that those others who persecuted their own population, their neighbours, or bombed our local pub were like me. Christ had died for them as well as me. And so all that was required of me was to accept them and love them as they were, whether they had warts or gunpowder on their hands. Hate the sin, not the sinner, my dad taught. Most of all, do it because it's right and God's will, not because your peers pressure you to. Those are good words to live by. War has dogged Europe for tens of centuries. There's been no century in which our ancestors did not witness war. We are tired of it. The European man on the street has lived through its horrors firsthand in his own country, not just witnessed it through the TV screen. We have built and lost our empires. In the process, we have learned the evil of subjugating other nations while hiding behind the claims of civilizing, modernizing, and proselytizing for God. We created misery, resentment, hatred, untold suffering. There is no country which doesn't have blood on its hands, but with these lessons emblazoned across the pages of our history, why would we fall for the same idiocy in the 21st century? That's not to say that all Europeans demonstrated against the recent attacks on Iraq, but the number of those who did not are small. The media lapdogs may hungrily grab and popularize the new euphemisms as feeds for the tired lies our monarchs and politicians used in the past. I recently asked my English students just to think about the euphemism we had out of the last attack on Iraq, shock and awe. Well, who the heck's not going to be shocked or awed when a bomb lands in their back garden? I just find it dismaying. But just because these euphemisms are pronounced in the accents of the new hegemonists, why would we not see them for what we are, what they are? From where we sit, the attacks on Iraq were a nightmarish replay of every empire-building conflict and excuse we have ever invented, pursued, and justified to our imperialist selves. The result of the American colonial enterprise will be the same chaotic crises that Europe spent the last 100 years fighting to be free of. Spencer Q. Kimball said, "Experience is a dear teacher, but fools will learn by no other." Our experiences has cost and is still costing us an exorbitant price in property, taxes, and humankind. The empire building of those past centuries have brought terrorism to our doorsteps. For the last 30 years in the UK, we have been bombed, mortared, and shot in the streets, our homes, and places of worship. Since the Second World War, the French, Germans, Dutch, and Spanish have all experienced their own conflicts and terrorist attacks. All over Europe, politicians and ordinary citizens alike have been targets. In Europe, we have a rich legacy in the many poets forged by the war we have come to call the First World War. One young man, Wilfred Owen, enlisted to help the young men at the front. "I came in order to help these boys," he said, "directly by leading them, as well as an officer can, indirectly by watching their sufferings that I might speak of them as well as a pleader can. I have done the first." Despite his modesty, his pleadings still echo clearly to those who will listen. His death, as well as his poetry, speak of the futility of war. On the 11th of November 1918, as the bells announcing the armistice rang out over Shrewsbury, England, the telegram announcing his death was delivered to his parents. He was only 25 years old. His visions of what was really happening in the hallowed halls of power and of the deception reverberate down through the years. His poem, The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. "So Abram rose, laid the wood, and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they spurned both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said, 'My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering?' Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps, and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth the knife to slay his son, when lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, 'Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him, thy son. Behold, caught in a thicket by its horns, a ram, offer the ram of pride instead.' But slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one." Why would Europeans want another war? We've had enough already. War results from gross stupidity and pride. That pride, greed, and avarice has already consumed too many of our people, young and old. The French and German attitudes have become the stuff of stories to frighten children. Are they all cowards? No, they're simply weary. In the UK, only the generation born in the dying years of the 20th century has not known terrorism or war firsthand. The face of the UK countryside and the hearts of her people teem with reminders of past conflicts. The French countryside and her citizens' souls are pockmarked with their own tokens and smears. Every year, the fields of Flanders vomit forth bombs and bodies lost in the quagmires of the First World War battlefields. Some German cities were almost entirely obliterated. People were asphyxiated in the streets when the Allies bombed them strategically. The death camps in Germany, which have never been dismantled, are eerie monuments where evil emanates from the very ground they infest, and no birds sing. I struggled to release them from my body. I have glimpsed perfection and divinity in their newborn faces. That miracle is a journey into the valley of the shadow of death. Indeed, there are those who do not return, but give their lives in the struggle to give life to their children. I have raised my children to be tolerant, patient with others, and respectful of alternative opinions. Although that doesn't always work when they're together. I am grateful to say they all objected to the attacks on Iraq. They are the kind of people to make many mothers' hearts swell, and I am grateful they were given to me. I live thousands of miles from my oldest three children, but that invisible cord that ties us to our Heavenly Father is replicated in the feelings I have for them, whatever they choose to be. I tremble at the thought of severing that mortal tie that binds their lives to mine. I understand the ferocity with which a lioness will defend her cubs. I dread that day when some maniac will provoke yet another war, which will engulf us all. I do not want my children to have to fight against their brothers and sisters, whatever shore they hail from, and know that other mothers weep and wail over the bodies of the children they too have battled to bring into the world. As women and I have been companions in that shadowed valley. 2 weeks ago, my youngest child turned 19. As she stood in my office on her birthday, organizing me, I was overwhelmed with the realization that she is still a miracle. Perfect in her idiosyncrasies, she still bears the stamp of the celestial and divine. We all do. I was struck by the thought, as I often am, that each one of those boys we sent out to fight is one of God's miracles. Each soldier who serves out there beyond our relatively safe community, each victim of terror and torture is another of those miracles. But also those who commit the atrocities, willingly or unwillingly, have somewhere a mother who has gone to the brink to bring them here. Knowing the trauma all combatants suffer, the horrors they are forced to perpetrate and witness, we then receive them back into our communities and expect them to return to normality. But inside their heads remain the atrocities and outrages committed in our names. We are increasingly importing time bombs, giving sanctuary to the emotionally maimed, and we will reap the bitter rewards. I have seen the men in my family, my grandfather, my dad, and my brother, left inarticulate by the memories of the conflicts in which they served. The medieval Scot Erasmus spoke truly. War is delightful to those who have had no experience of it. I want God's children to be sacrificed for some madman's pride. I do not want them exposed to the horrors of war. The minds of the young men sent out to fight, even today, in our names, are irreparably damaged by it. I do not want to see my children's minds tormented by the images of death and pestilence, which are an hourly part of war. I do not want them to see bodies blown apart by their hands, and for the nightmares which would move within their minds, night and day. I do not want to see those miracles of creation which I have felt move within me, laid in a cold tomb, and weep in the night haunted by the monsters they became. I would fear for the tortures they might suffer before they die on some distant foreign field. All women are my sisters. Why would I wish those fears on them, or support any action which would suffer them to those fears? I demonstrated against the attack on Iraq because it went against the teachings of Jesus Christ as I understood them. Peace is not bought by aggression. It's not bought by hatred, nor murder by the military. War destroys the sensitivities of the souls we compel to commit those crimes against humanity. It breeds hatred in their hearts and violates the earth over which we are stewards. War diffuses darkness and fear over this glittering orb, a darkness and fear which infiltrated my heart 10,000 miles from the scene of the attack. What damage has it done in the hearts and souls of those on whom the attack was perpetrated? It has left those lands in utter darkness. The fear and distrust of American infidels has been increased. How much of an extra burden has the pursuit of things of the evil men who instigated those attacks placed on the shoulders of the Lord as he works to bring light and knowledge to the world? I pray the opportunity has not been extinguished. Do we have a duty as Latter-day Saints to avoid war? Yes, I believe we do. More importantly, that duty is ours by virtue of the fact that we are all God's children and therefore brothers in a literal sense, neighbors. Christ's second commandment was to love others as we love ourselves. Love our neighbors. Is there any alternative to war? Yes, change ourselves. However, to do it requires that we put our trust in the Lord and not the politicians who seek to secure their own fortunes and a place in history. History books are peopled by murderers, saints, and prodigies. To which category should we assign those cowards who would wage war only on those who are less well equipped than we? I love history. I come from a continent steeped in it. I believe we should learn from it, not repeat it. We are living in a time of fear and distrust, feelings generated by the actions of ungodly men. We are allowing them to lead us along the same path trod by the worst dictators to infest the world. The small island which was my home has experienced centuries of war. Every century in the 2 millennia of history we teach our children has been blighted by war. We live in a time when we can more freely discuss the truths of human experience, although the media still sterilize the reality of war. There are those who are returning from the front today who are willing to tell the truth. The movies the US government made of World War II veterans crippled by PTSD were never released because the truth they contained would have destroyed the will of the populace to support any other war. The men consigned to live a Boo Radley-type existence suffered in silence. We can strike preemptively against the continuing cycle of their pain and horror. When we pursue war, nations reel, families are destroyed, individuals are scarred beyond recognition. For our own sakes, we must require change from our leaders. If we do not start a revolution of peace, then we consign our children to reap a bitter harvest, and Mother Earth and our more distant heirs to centuries more agony and anguish. War is terrorism. War is foul and obscene. War destroys hopes and dreams, is profane and evil, as are the men who arouse the fear and hatred of others to provoke and manipulate the populace into fighting and supporting the war. There is little which is heroic, glorious, or of good report when our children find themselves engaged in deadly combat. War defeats God's purpose for us. If love is God's commandment, then war is the devil's entreaty. I almost feel like saying, in the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
Picturing a blonde, petite fireball of a woman as I read her essay, that would help. I carry a credit card-sized map of the United States in my wallet. It's from Richard L. Miller's book, Under the Cloud, The Decades of Nuclear Testing, and it shows where radioactive fallout went during the 12 years of atmospheric testing from 1951 to 1962 at the Nevada test site. Utah and Nevada are almost completely blacked out, as you can see, we have on the screen there, and the black ink spreads as far east as New York and as far north as Canada. And I noticed that California, actually they didn't test until the winds were going away from California, which is one reason why my childhood friends have mostly survived where Mary's have not. I carry that map as a way of bearing witness and as a warning to remain vigilant. If If the Bush administration has its way, we could see another round of nuclear testing at the Nevada test site, along with the hollow assurances that it is safe. I don't need any reminders of what fallout did to people living in those areas of black on Miller's map. There is another map I carry, one that is drawn by the scars on my body. At age 29, I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer, one of the most common cancers in those exposed to fallout as children. In the following years, other tumors led to a hysterectomy. As a child growing up in Salt Lake City, I was under the clouds from atomic testing. I ate the snow, I drank the milk, and ate the vegetables. How was I to know they contained radiation from fallout? I keep a list of people I've known over the years who have become sick or died. It includes my sister, who lost her life 3 years ago, and 42 people we grew up with in our Salt Lake City neighborhood. The list continues to grow. Those of us who have survived are walking witnesses that radiation works in strange ways. It doesn't kill you outright. It attacks cells that mutate and sometimes take years to manifest as cancer, leukemia, and other autoimmune diseases. The genetic damage it causes can be passed on to future generations. Not only does the long lag time between our exposure and our illness make it hard to prove they are linked, it also makes it easier for our government to forget us and the fallout which we are convinced made us sick. Had we become ill or died immediately following those blasts in the Nevada desert, our numbers would have been considered a national catastrophe far worse than what happened on September 11th. I just want to mention, too, that she actually lived near a canyon area in Salt Lake City where they theorized that the canyon walls kind of collected the radiation, so that's why there's so many in that part of Salt Lake City. And the same thing happened in Ogden, Kansas. From 1951 to 1962, the U.S. government dropped more than 100 nuclear bombs on the desert of Nevada as part of the massive program of nuclear testing. When atmospheric testing was banned in 1962, tests continued to be conducted underground until 1992. More than half of the 804 underground detonations leaked radiation into the atmosphere. Government data shows that fallout from 4 decades of nuclear tests hit virtually every county in the contiguous 48 states, leading to cancers and other radiation-related illnesses as far as 2,300 miles from the desert of Nevada. Can we look at map two? This map shows how far the radiation traveled in a different way. Actually, I think they're tracking thyroid illnesses here. And I know Nebraska is where my mother's family comes from, and I know there's been a fair amount of illness in my mother's relatives in Nebraska who lived on farms. During those 4 decades, American citizens like me became the expendable victims of the Cold War. Sadly, most Americans today mistakenly think that atomic testing affected only southern Utah. Radiation does not respect arbitrary lines on a map. It is picked up by the jet stream and carried across the country. That's how it got to Albany, Utica, and Troy, New York. Bill Heller, an Albany journalist who wrote A Good Day Has No Rain, documented how fallout doused upstate New York in the aftermath of a shot called Simon, detonated on April 15, 1953, in the Nevada desert. Radioactive fallout from that test was picked up by the jet stream and rained out on upstate New York during an extremely violent thunderstorm. Queens County, New York, twice ranked number one in terms of fallout in the entire country. A 1997 article, wait a minute, you know when the next map we're ready for it. A 1997 article in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists told what happened at Eastman Kodak Company in Rochester, New York. In 1951, 2 days after testing began at the Nevada test site, Kodak's Geiger counters detected high levels of radiation in the snow that blanketed the city. When Kodak complained that its film was foggy, the Atomic Energy Commission agreed to provide the company advance warning of nuclear blasts so they could protect the film. The American people were never given the same courtesy. It's impossible to prove how how many cancers or other illnesses across this country may be linked to fallout. According to a 15-year National Cancer Institute study, as many as 75,000 cases of thyroid cancer alone likely are related to testing. Declassified documents show that many government officials knew the facts about fallout and that they systematically lied to the American people for decades, assuring us there is no danger. That's why we downwinders take no comfort from our government's assurances that should testing resume, it will be underground and pose no danger. We remember other underground tests suspended, including the notorious December 18, 1970, Bainbury shot, which spewed radioactive debris 10,000 feet into the skies, where it was picked up by the jet stream and tracked all the way to Canada. So this is photo number three there. And this is the Bainbury shot with its 10,000 foot stream into the atmosphere. Yes, oh yes, they look like above ground tests, and half of them leaked. That was in 1970. Okay. We remember the July 6, 1962 shot sedan, which sent radioactive debris 16,000 feet into the atmosphere, where it was carried by the winds across the country as far as the Atlantic Ocean. And that's photo number four. And then five is going to be right behind us. All right. This is shot sedan. 16,000 feet into the atmosphere. This is an underground test. And that explosion left a crater 1,200 feet wide and 300 feet deep, and that's the next and last photo. That's the crater. Shot Sedan's fall did not hit southern Utah, but rained out most heavily in northern Utah, where a University of Utah radiologist independently tracked it across the Wasatch Front on his Geiger counter. And that was 1962. What have we learned from our nuclear past? Despite everything we know about the health consequences of nuclear testing, the current administration is pushing to develop a new generation of nuclear weapons that will undeniably lead to a renewed round of testing. To me, even contemplating the resumption of nuclear testing is not only immoral, but criminal. As downwinders, we are outraged at this administration's callous abandonment of the hard-won ban on nuclear testing. At the president's request, Congress lifted the ban this past year on mini nukes, fully funded research for a new bunker buster nuclear weapon, and in November authorized spending $25 million to upgrade the Nevada test site so that it can be ready to resume underground testing within 18 months. The wheels are being set in motion. Not only is such a course disastrous and hypocritical as a step backwards that could easily trigger a new arms race, but according to Princeton University physicist Robert Nelson, an explosion caused by even a small nuclear device could blow out a crater and send a huge cloud of radioactive dust and debris into the atmosphere. The military has not requested these weapons. Rather, the so-called bunker busters and mini nukes are the idea of an administration bent on using any means in the war on terror. You can tell that they're not a fan of President Bush. But physicists like Nelson have said that these weapons are useless in such a war. Not only would they fail to destroy caches of buried chemical and biological weapons, but they would disperse those agents along with radioactive debris into the atmosphere. How could such weapons have prevented a September 11th in New York City or a March 11th in Madrid? How will testing such weapons make Americans safer? When bombs are exploded on the lands of innocent people, leading to sickness and death months, years, decades later, is that not in itself an act of terror, regardless of who detonates those bombs? As my friend Darlene Phillips, another downwinder, said, nuclear testing has nothing to do with the war on terror. It is terror itself. Is the war on terror like the war on communism, worth sacrificing our own people again? Perhaps it is a matter of perspective. We're at war because terrorists killed 3,000 Americans. How many more Americans did our own government kill with atomic testing? If our government resumes nuclear testing, we could again become expendable in the name of national defense. If we learned anything from being the unwitting subjects of the massive experiment of atomic testing, it is that we are all downwinders. Now, Mary, by the way, I know her full essay. It's much longer, much more developed, and massive footnotes along with it. She also talks more about her own personal story, which is actually pretty horrendous about what her own health problems have been. And I know she left that out of it, but it is in the essay I urge you to read.
We have till 12:45. I feel a little bit guilty having a semi-academic, semi-dispassionate essay to present after those, but we'll see how it goes. This month, the world remembers, celebrates its term, the 10-year anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda, one of the world's most horrific events since the Holocaust and the dropping of the atomic bombs nearly 60 years ago. Partly in remembrance of the suffering of the million people that died in that bloody month of genocide, and partly to introduce the rest of my remarks, I want to share a powerful, if disturbing, true story from Rwanda, April 1994, that I heard 2 weeks ago at a night of remembrance, sponsored by the Rwandan students at Notre Dame. You'll remember that the genocide was carried out at the behest of the majority Hutu government against the Tutsi minority, who had generally been favored by Rwanda's European colonial rulers. Spurred on by anti-Tutsi radio propaganda, Hutu patrols would go through their own hometowns, seeking out their Tutsi neighbors and butchering them, usually by machete. Any Hutus that sought to shelter Tutsis, or who did not appear sympathetic enough to Hutu power, were also slaughtered. My story is of a Hutu man who was determined to protect as many of his Tutsi friends and neighbors as possible. To do so, he hid as many as 50 Tutsis in a cramped but concealed shelter. Trying to avoid any possible suspicion, the man actively participated in the anti-Tutsi demonstrations that went on in his community. He would fervently chant the vitriolic slogans, and from all outward appearances, seemed to be one of the most enthusiastic Tutsi haters in town. It was all a dangerous charade to protect dozens of innocent people from certain death. However, as so often happens, this deal with the devil caught up with him. One day he was outside his home when one of the toddlers he was sheltering unexpectedly came out of the hiding place, not fully understanding the precariousness of the situation. A Hutu patrolman spied the child and demanded to know where its family was. Panicking and not knowing what else to do, this man started screaming anti-Tutsi slogans and shot the child before it could identify where the hiding place was. The other 50 hidden Tutsis survived through the genocide. This terrible bargain with evil starkly illustrates that ambivalence, the ambivalence that violence brings to the moral actor. Of course, ambivalence is far too weak a word to describe the anguish of soul that this Rwandan man must have felt, but it does reflect the inability to reduce life down to neat dualisms, good and evil, moral and immoral, even war and peace, when dealing with issues of violence. Recognizing that ambivalence is in fact a fundamental aspect of our mortal probation goes far in helping us to be invigorated rather than paralyzed by complexity. It's this ability to constructively engage complexity that I want to focus on today as I reflect briefly on the possibilities of a distinctive brand of Mormon peacebuilding, both drawing from and building on the thoughts that I published in Dialogue. To set the table, I want to read a few sentences from that article. In terms of religious peacebuilding, Mormonism may well have a distinct advantage over many strains of conservative Protestant evangelicalism and fundamentalism. Peacebuilding requires, if nothing else, getting one's hands dirty. It is the complete antithesis of the retreat from culture
the holy hovering above the fray, so common among many fundamentalists of all religious traditions, including but not limited to Protestantism. Peace building involves a willingness to work with and even embrace complexity, hardly the forte of fundamentalists who see the world through the lens of cosmic dualism, where everything is black and white, good or evil. Mormonism's rich theology of the mortal probation, Paul perhaps says it best when he says we see through a glass darkly, is in many ways the ideal foundation for working in the world with a high sense of moral purpose and even divine calling. While conceding that we cannot achieve a full measure of truth, justice, and peace in this life, we can not only strive for it, but are, in fact, expected to do so as part of our discipleship, always retaining the humility that we act with a limited view. Once peace builders recognize that their perspective is incomplete at best, their newfound humility hopefully leads to a greater empathy and respect for others, and they become increasingly willing to consider multiple points of view. Humility and self-criticism, continually monitoring and checking and chastening one's own motives and intentions, thus become part of the foundation for effective peace building, along with perseverance, compassion, and justice. Certainly, most of us are far removed from the horrors of Rwanda, and especially for middle-class Americans such as myself, our personal experience with direct violence is extremely limited. However, given an ever-shrinking global community, it becomes more and more difficult for us to pretend that we can easily ignore the reality for most of the Earth's inhabitants involves violence of all kinds, physical, structural, and cultural. How can members of the Latter-day Saint tradition more effectively and compassionately respond to the violence that is so endemic in our world? After all, just as Jesus is saying at the Last Supper that ye have the poor with you always, was issued as a challenge rather than as an excuse, so is the presence of both the perpetrators and victims of violence a call to action, not simply a source of long-distance pity as we enter the 21st century. There are three areas, at least, that we must engage as we think of the possibilities of Mormon peacebuilding: scripture, history or tradition, and institutions. Let me take each in turn, offering a few insights and suggestions about the complexity and ambivalence in each, how they may serve as a stepping stone rather than a stumbling block on our path to peace building. First, scripture. If the past 2,000 years of Christian history, and especially the 5.5 centuries since the invention of the printing press, have taught us anything, it's that scripture, whether on parchment, plates, or paper, is highly malleable. Two excellent recent books, American Jesus by Stephen Prothero and Jesus in America by Richard Fox, demonstrate how Jesus has been appropriated, shaped, assimilated, and reconfigured by Christians and non-Christians alike throughout American history, with various individuals or groups essentially doing a makeover on Jesus, some more extreme than others, usually with the outcome of him looking a lot like the makeover artists themselves. The tremendous internal pluralism in Christianity, and even within the Mormon tradition, need not be seen as a betrayal of a once pristine golden age, but rather the inevitable historical result of fundamental scriptural texts that are often at odds with themselves. For our purposes, consider the Jesus of the Gospels. Is he the meek and mild lamb who turns his cheek to his smiters and brings peace on earth, goodwill toward men? Or is he the triumphant Lord who drives many changers from the temple with a whip and who came not to send peace but a sword? Although more lamb than lion in the narrative of the four Gospels, when one takes all the scriptural record together, especially considering Mormons' belief that Jesus was the Jehovah of the Old Testament, one is left with a God who is either incredibly complex or tragically schizophrenic. I think most of us prefer the former, but it means we have to come to terms with him in all his complexity. If we discuss difficult issues, we should do our best to take the scriptures as a whole, rather than as proof texts. Latter-day Saints, and probably most believers, have a long and impressive history of proof texting, much of which is still carried on in Sunday school classes and missionary work, and a lot of academic presentations. But I suggest that a theoretical basis to Mormon peacebuilding must grapple with the issues of peace and violence in Scripture in their entirety. The Book of Alma is the most wonderful example of this, I think, placing archetypal Christian warriors right next to self-sacrificing pacifist martyrs, and saying that they're all going to heaven. As believers, scholars, or peace builders, we need to learn that Captain Moroni and the anti-Nephi Lehis are not separate dishes in a scriptural and ideological cafeteria, but rather coexisting ingredients in a gospel stew. To used the scripture positively in peace building then, we must learn to divorce our personal politics from theology, and then learn to put them back together in more constructive ways. And as students love to hear as the teacher passes out the exam, there will be no one right answer. Next, what do Mormon history and tradition have to tell us? As I sketch out in my essay, Mormon history is ultimately ambivalent rather than providing an absolute stance on war and peace. Historically, the leaders and general membership of the church were typically engaged in peacetime support of conciliation, arms limitation, disarmament, and a general normative commitment to peace. However, as has been the case for most American Christians, Mormon peacetime pacifism usually dissipated in the expediency of wartime conditions. Ever since a brief era of pacifism in the earliest years of the church, which was probably born more of pragmatism than absolute principle, Latter-day Saints have generally been willing to take up arms for their faith or their country. This isn't going to change anytime soon, at least in the LDS Church, certainly not when seemingly half of the talks in priesthood session of General Conference feature war stories, and when the president of the church announces from the pulpit that he personally supports the current war effort against Iraq, even despite the general evils of war that he cited. Even so, there's much within Mormon theology and history for potential peace builders to take from and build upon. The real challenge is not in finding inspiration from the past, but rather in looking to the future. Even if one finds in Mormonism the rationale and even moral obligation to engage in a life of peace building, it must be remembered that Mormon theology, history, and culture are ultimately ambivalent about how a believer should respond in the face of violent aggression. Most Mormons will continue to follow Captain Moroni, but those who choose Lamoni's path should not see themselves necessarily morally superior, or as better or truer or more faithful disciples of Christ. If the emergence of a Mormon peace-building community were to bring schism and disharmony to the body of Christ, I'm not sure that even I could support it. That leads me to my final resource for Mormon peace-building, the institutions of the church itself. I should say up front that, speaking honestly, I'm constantly impressed at the influence for good that the church is in the life of most of its members, and many of the non-members of the church. From home teaching to humanitarian aid to Relief Society dinners to the Perpetual Education Fund, the church is an amazing institution that administers sincerely and compassionately, if imperfectly, to both the physical and spiritual needs of millions of people around the world. Therefore, rather than reforming or transforming an already effective institution, I propose that we simply draw upon its strengths to do even more good in the world, in this case, the world of peace building. Like everything else, this is not so uncomplicated as it sounds. The church is and should be primarily devoted to the saving of souls, and with inherently limited time and resources, it's a no-brainer what gets first priority. However, first priorities should rarely become only priorities. The church's humanitarian and welfare programs, along with a vast force of returned missionaries, will be the building blocks for Mormon peace-building work. Again, not everyone will be interested or involved, but for those who are, they have wonderful resources and examples at their fingertips. The institutions and programs of the church should never become an obstacle to potential Mormon peace-builders, but rather a great ally and inspiration, much like the example of the Catholic peace-building group San Egidio and their relationship to the official Roman Catholic Church. Finally, let me add that I believe that the cornerstone to peace-building is peace education. In terms of Mormon peace-building, this may mean a variety of things, including, to name just a few, the establishment of a peace studies and conflict transformation curriculum at Brigham Young University, more frequent and sustained discussion of the sins of physical, structural, and cultural violence, including racism, sexism, and even current issues in church classes, especially for teenagers and adults. And finally, more sessions like this, where people can gather and talk about these issues openly and honestly, and most importantly, listen. To that end, I'll shut up and sit down and listen to what the rest of you have to say.
We have a good 10 minutes here for questions, so, hands are going up. Do you want to come up here? So I assume it's being taped, and that way you'll be on the tape. Would you rather have me do that? Repeat it? Okay. All right. Oh, you're here already. You can come and speak into the mic. How about right here? This tape down, it is immovable.
Well, my first comment is that I'm totally concentrated on this so-called war, which is an invasion of Iraq. And as a participant in the Second World War, and being in the British Army in the Second World War, I have some knowledge of war, and I'm absolutely appalled and saddened to see how people who have never participated in war and are leading this country and deliberately go into Iraq, who have been their friend for years, and then they changed their minds. But to go into Iraq when we were after a terrorist, but terrorism was forgotten and we went in there. But I just wanted to say that person who hopes we can learn from others, from what's gone before, this invasion into Iraq, that they proudly announce what they did when we're the richest country. We have unlimited riches. We have weapons of war that nobody else can possibly have the money to build, and we go in there and do as we like, but with young people who don't deserve to have to go and so-called fight there. They're not even dressed in the right clothes. Parents have to buy armor for them because what the government provides is no good. And the whole thing is so horrible. I had to dive into oh, I'm sorry, my head stops, into an air raid shelter. When you hear a bomb dropping, you run for it and dive into the little shelters we had in the backyard. That was very early on. And I did want to mention something that was said here, this about how we blanket bombed Germany. The only time that happened was towards the end of the war. You have to realize that war went on for 6 years in England. And we had nothing to bomb Germany with, basically, until we had those Spitfires that were holding off the German bombers on London. But we didn't have any bombers until America came in after Japan, and Japan did Pearl Harbor, which we all cheered, I have to tell you, because we knew then the U.S. would have to come in, because we were Hitler had all his invasion plans all busy. The barges were already in the English Channel, and he changed his mind and went to Russia. But there's no excuse for this so-called war. Nothing can make it right. And I don't know how they're ever going to get out of it now. You know, we've got to face it. But I just wanted to say, saying Churchill bombed all these places, you must remember, they came over, they bombed, tried to obliterate London. Coventry, a perfectly innocent town, was so forth. And I can remember a friend of mine that was in the army with me went home on leave to Coventry. When she got there, the whole street was gone where her parents lived. Her parents with her. So when at the end of the war they bombed Dresden, we thought it was terrible too, that lovely city. We thought, and it had to be the Americans that bombed it, because they, you know, it was Roosevelt and Churchill who were working together. And as I say, what was the big bombers belonged to the Americans, all going from the UK. But I can remember feeling sad for Dresden, but thinking, oh well, you know, it's just some sort of somebody feeling like they had to get their own back, you know. Anyway, I've talked too much, and I hope I made a bit of sense.
Material to select from and chose to select those things because they